I got inspired to want to be a performer and to get into recording from a lot of the sort of new wave punk music in the late 70s, early 80s. And what I liked about some of that music is I kind of felt like it was kicking against some of the mainstream music that you heard on the radio. I grew up in Viroqua, Wisconsin, and my mom was a music teacher, and she bought tons of records, but pretty much mainstream records, everything from Frank Sinatra to the Beatles to the Tijuana Brass and everything in between. So I really grew up loving pop music, but when I really grew into listening to music that I felt I could relate to identity-wise, that's when I became inspired, and really that's when I joined a band, and that's when I started getting interested in recording.
And as a producer, you started out with noise rock and post-punk bands, right?
As a producer, I recorded a ton of indie bands, almost all of them punk. And I did a lot of projects for labels like Touch and Go, Mammoth, Twin Tone, Sub Pop. And the great thing about those records was there was just a sense of freedom. There were absolutely no restraints, as well as there was no budget for any of them, really. It was all, had to do them really fast and by the seat of your pants. But some of those records were actually quite ambitious, and I always encouraged the artists to experiment in the studio because I love to experiment in the studio, and some of those early records I did are actually quite left field, even for left field sounding albums, like Killdozer's 12 Point Buck, which we sort of laughingly refer to as their quote-unquote white album. But that inevitably, records like that are what got the attention of some of the other bigger indie bands that I worked with, like Smashing Pumpkins and Nirvana. They fell in love with those Killdozer records I did.
So you think it was because they were left field, because they were outside of those mainstream trends that they got attention?
Yeah, I think that they wanted to sound, with a band like Smashing Pumpkins, they wanted to have their own identity, and they heard in some of those records that I was doing that they were left field and they were outside of the mainstream. And they liked it that that they had a sort of a character that was quite different from what was going on, especially at the major labels. And a band like the Pumpkins, they definitely had their own identity, and that's one of the first things that I sat down with Billy Corgan, is he said, I really want to capture my vision. I don't want to adhere to what anybody thinks we should be or what we should sound like. And if you listen to their music, it was heavy and dreamy, and he was Billy's lyrics and his singing could come across as being very feminine sometimes. The band looked cool. They just had a way of playing that was, it could float and go on these jazzy, exponential, trippy moments, and it could pummel you over the head. And that's the kind of, when I first met him, said, I want to make music like this. And it wasn't necessarily, he wasn't really trying to follow any trend at all. I mean, he wanted to follow his path. And if anything, I think Billy wanted to avoid anything that he thought was a trend, at least from the major labels.
Was he thinking very much about kind of commercial success, or was it more about artistic integrity?
Well, it's a fine line. I mean, he wanted to do it his way. He wanted to make records that were challenging. But in the back of his head, I think he knew to really have some sort of success, you have to get your songs played on the radio. How can you do that and retain your identity and the sound, and your character, and still start to find more of a mainstream audience? And ultimately, I think that's what attracted Billy was attracted to me, because as I said earlier, I did have a pop sensibility. And amidst all of the noise and chaos and the wall of guitars, I tried to really focus the melodic aspects. And it's the same with Nirvana. I mean, Kurt wanted to make a very ambitious record, but he wanted it to sound really simple. And I think that's also why Sub Pop called me, because he Jonathan at Sub Pop knew that I could help sort of focus their raw energy and make them sound really powerful, but really make sure the songs are well-crafted.
So it sounds almost like you were a mediator between that artistic integrity and that desire also for commercial success and maybe for a little bit of mainstream acceptance. Is that fair?
Totally. I think I've always been somewhat of a mediator between artistic integrity and mainstream commercial success. Because I've played in bands and grew up as a musician and a songwriter, I understand what artists are going through, because you don't want to be forced into doing something that you feel uncomfortable with just to achieve a way of achieving commercial success. And that's a slippery slope to deal with. And I always sort of lean towards trying to find what the band's vision is first, and really sort of allowing them to kind of breathe and do their thing. And somewhere in the midst of that, I hopefully can sort of rein in a couple of the songs, or usually the term I use is focus the songs and really bring out the hooks or the melodic aspects that might give them a chance, at least, to get some more mainstream airplay or commercial success.
And so when you're focusing them and reining them in, how much are you thinking about the landscape of the industry at that time?
I always am kind of aware of what's going on. I always have been, because I listen to a lot of music. I've always bought magazines. You know, I read reviews. I like to sort of see what's going on. And part of that was because when I first started out as a engineer and a producer, I wanted to know how they made the sounds of those records. So I would always buy things and listen to the drum sound, or listen to the guitar sound, or the balances that they had in a mix. And the other part of that is just because I love music. And even now, I still listen to tons and tons of music. So I'm always kind of aware of what's going on in the world around me. I try to sort of shut that out to a certain extent. It's hard if you're listening to something, especially something you love, that becomes a big success. It's hard to sort of shut that out completely, because obviously I think that everything you listen to in some way or form can influence you, even if it's a very subtle way. And I know that music that I love over the years has influenced me, whether it's the production or the songwriting or the vibe. But I think sometimes I have to shut that out a little bit and just really focus on what the band's vision is. And that's not always easy to do, especially if there's a song that they have that I feel could be better if it's arranged better, or if the melodic structure has changed, or if maybe the song isn't so fuzzy sounding, whatever. It could be any number of things.
I want to ask you a little bit about working on Nevermind. It was huge, right? It was kind of the calling card of grunge, which probably wasn't being called grunge at that point in time.
No, it wasn't.
Were you and the band conscious of what you were doing, that you were in fact shaping a trend?
When I was producing Nevermind, I knew the songs were amazing, but I had no idea it was going to profoundly change my life and their life and the musical landscape. I mean, it changed the music business. And as I said, even though we knew the songs were good, you have no idea that it's just going to completely blow everything out of the water. I mean, I remember the week it went number one, I called up their manager, John Silva, Nirvana's manager, and said, "John, is there any chance this could go number one?" He said, "Not a chance, not with Michael Jackson there." And next week, indeed, it blew right by Michael Jackson. And the funny thing is that immediately, and this is something the record industry always does, after the success of Nirvana, it became apparent that all the labels just would change their direction, and they all wanted to sign alternative rock bands that sounded like Nirvana. And all of a sudden, there were 1,000 bands that were signed that sounded like Nirvana. And that happens all the time, where labels see a trend happening and a band that blows up, and then they just try to duplicate that success. Obviously, there were a lot of bands that did do really well, and some sort of came out of that area. You know, I mean, Pearl Jam, they were well on their way to doing that. And a band like the Pumpkins, they had their own identity, but they were well on their way to achieving some success. But Nirvana really did allow that. It like opened up all those portals for everyone who never had heard a band with a flannel shirt before could embrace it. And it killed the hair metal bands.
What was that experience like for you, having worked with Nirvana to create something that went so big, and then just see people try to kind of do one-offs of it?
You know, I've seen that happen a bunch of times with bands where they get success and then everyone tries to duplicate it. I find it annoying and I find it sort of flattering at the same time. What was really sort of difficult for me to get my head around is I got tons of phone calls all of a sudden from managers and labels, and they would say, we want you to produce this band. I'm going to send you a tape. You know, we really want you to do your thing with them, what you did with Nirvana. And I'd go, okay. And then I'd get the tape in the mail the next day, and it would be a blues singer or a folk singer or something that was totally not appropriate, that didn't sound anything like Nirvana. And that happened to me hundreds of times, where everyone just thought I had some sort of magic button I could push that would make them sound like Nirvana. And after a while, it got pretty annoying, and I sort of started looking for other things to do that were sort of completely different from alternative grunge bands. I fell in love with Freddie Johnston, who was a singer-songwriter, and I produced his album, This Perfect World. And at the time, I remember people saying, oh man, you should be doing some more big rock records now. This is your time. And I kind of did a U-turn to a certain extent. And then again, later I did another U-turn when I started Garbage. And that also in itself started kind of a whole nother trend of bands incorporating the use of different kinds of styles of music and mixed all together, you know, beats and electronic and guitars and hip hop, and then all of a sudden, after the success of Garbage, there were 1,000 bands that sounded like Garbage too.
Where do you see Garbage in relation to trends in the industry? I mean, the band's been around for what, at least 8 years, right?
Yeah, I don't really know where Garbage fits in. I do know that part of the reason I started the band was a reaction to the alternative rock scene that I helped create. I got bored with producing records that were guitar, bass, and drums. And I wanted to start to use the studio as more of a writing tool, especially using samplers. And you know, we weren't maybe the first band to really do that, but just the way we put that first record together, it really caught people by surprise. And then the record went on to have a huge mainstream success, and there were hundreds of bands that started sounding like us. And again, I sort of find that annoying and flattering at the same time. And you know, you can't really control it. I guess once you do something that catches people's ears, people are going to mimic it.
Do you ever, or have you ever felt like, hey, this trend is actually kind of cool, I want to get on board?
You know, I think when I listen to what's going on trend-wise in music, for me, it's always exciting when someone can kind of break a boundary to a certain extent. Like last year, I fell in love with this band, Sleigh Bells, and their music is sort of blown out beats and chants, almost like with cheerleader chants over blown out drum machine and guitar riffs. And it's nothing really new, but they somehow did something to make it sound fresh. And all of a sudden now I've started hearing a bunch of other bands that sound like them. I mentioned this earlier. I do listen to music and production techniques and things that are going on, trends that are developing. I do get influenced by those. I don't know that they necessarily will come across as being obvious, but it may be the sound of a mix, or it could be the sound of how they're dealing with the vocals, or it could be the attitude or the vibe. Is it really hi-fi sounding, or is it super lo-fi and trashy and dirty sounding? And I'm constantly picking up on those little things. And as I said, they do influence me. I'm not always sure as to what extent, but it's not really a conscious process. But I think if I could sit down, like with a new Garbage record, I could probably sit down and go through a song and go, oh yeah, that guitar sound, that reminds me of blah, 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 or whatever, something that I maybe heard last year. And it's kind of hard. I'm maybe not the most objective person either. If someone else could, when they hear the new Garbage record, they may be able to pick out some of the influences better than me, because obviously I get way too close to it. But, I think anybody who is working in music these days, they're going to be influenced by something that's going on around them, and if you listen to music at all, even if you don't like it, I think sometimes that can also influence you, and maybe in a good way, because you look at it like, that really sucks, I do not want it, the record to sound like that.
I want to shift now to talking about distribution a little bit. and platforms. But I want to make sure that you feel like we've covered your relationship with trans, how they affect or have affected your work.
It's interesting to have someone tell me that I have started trends, because I don't know when I'm in the process of making a record or working on something that it's a deliberate thing. Sometimes I think trying to do exactly the opposite and establish your own identity, you know, establish your own sort of sound or course, or your own vision, actually, without you knowing it, can start a trend, especially if people like it. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a commercial success. It could be a critical success that other bands notice and that critics notice, and can be an influence on hundreds or thousands of other bands or artists. And how that sort of happens, it's really difficult to pigeonhole. But I do know that, as I said earlier, trying to block out what's going on around you, at least for me, is a good thing, because I think in doing that, you're able to get somewhere where you can work on a body of music that ultimately could start to become a new trend. There are some artists who are incredible at manipulating trends. I mean, look at Lady Gaga. She is the queen of marketing and has done her own thing, and you know, and her music is not entirely original, but she's sort of gone back and mined all these references, especially like disco and dance music from the 80s, and kind of put a fresh spin on it and written some good songs. And she, you know, I mean, if you listen to what's going on pop radio with her and Katy Perry and artists like that, I mean, they all sort of, I think they, to a certain extent, do look over each other's shoulders a little bit, especially when someone has a massive hit. You know, they'll go, is it the producer? Was it the songwriter? Is it the mix? Is it the vibe? You know, people, especially managers and A&R people at record companies, they go in and they sort of try to analyze it because they want to duplicate that success. The thing is with trends, the music business is always evolving. And sometimes what happens, if you want to jump on a trend, by the time you get your record done and out, it could have moved on to something else, you know, that is the flavor of the moment. And so that's, I think in some ways it's a dangerous thing to try and duplicate a trend or try to jump on it, because it could be over faster than you're ready for it to be over.
Right. It seems like the industry is just changing immensely because of all the new platforms now. I'm thinking about MySpace and Facebook and YouTube. Do they matter?
There's a whole new playing field out there now in terms of how you can market your album, market your music, make yourself known. And really, it's all come from the digital revolution. And the digital revolution has made great strides in how easy it is to record. I mean, you can make an amazing sounding record in your house on your laptop now that was not even, you couldn't comprehend doing that 15 or 20 years ago. The one thing that I don't like about the digital revolution is because music is so easy to get on the internet now that I really think it's devalued the value of music. So it's not only the labels that are, you know, bitching and moaning that they have no model, you know, they have no way to sell their product anymore. Ultimately, it does hurt artists too, because it's really difficult to actually sell CDs or MP3s these days. On the flip side of that, the great thing is, because it's leveled the playing field, you can be an unknown artist and make a piece of music in your basement, and you can post it on YouTube, and you can kind of be an overnight sensation. You know, you can go from playing a club in your hometown for 50 people to playing on stage in a theater to 5,000 people, or going on a stadium tour opening for someone because they fell in love with your music. And in a way, everyone's had to rethink, and they still are rethinking, how do you get your music out there now? Now, we're going through this with Garbage because we just finished a new album, and it's coming out this spring. And we have decided to put it out on our own label. And so we are going through the process of trying to figure out how we're going to use all the digital marketing and the social networking and try to tap into our fan base and do it all ourselves and avoid a label. And it's exciting and scary at the same time. We're still sort of in the process of figuring all that out, but we are definitely going to embrace the new technology and that new sort of digital marketing universe out there. And we're going to jump in 100%.
The whole thing makes me wonder if the new media stuff and the MP3s and the death of the CD makes it easier for people to get attention and also less easy for them to get attention. Because if you have suddenly all these people in their basements putting out videos, how does a person stand out? How does a group stand out?
I think it's pretty tough to stand out these days. I mean, I don't know what the count is, but if you go on YouTube, there's probably 5 million bands on there or something crazy. I don't know what it is, but anybody can post anything they want. And there's no arbiter of quality. And not that there should be, but it's like we're sort of inundated with so much music and so many bands that it's just completely watered down. Now, some people argue that because of that, if you actually do have something good, if you write a good song, it's going to stick up. It's going to stick its head up and get noticed because it's just in a sea of mediocrity. Anything that shines is like a beacon in the night, and people are going to be drawn to it. It's difficult to sort of understand the consumer these days, because I think our whole generation of youth growing up also really has a very short attention span. I mean, the death of the album is sort of imminent, and people don't really want to listen to a long body of work. I heard a story last week about kids these days. They don't even listen to the song all the way through. They put the song on, and they listen up through the first chorus, and they click to the next song. They just want to get on to the next thing right away. It's kind of frightening that you can't just allow that time and space to sort of let the music breathe a little bit and have that 4 minutes or whatever it is to just enjoy the song or whatever, to sort of, slip into your imagination and listen to it. And unfortunately, that's the way of the world right now. So it is really difficult to sort of figure out what the consumer is going to want or be interested in moving forward, because it's quite complex right now. And the trends that are developing, at least that I see, are that, as I said earlier, music is getting devalued, but also just consumers, just their attention span is so short that they don't really have any patience to stay with anything.
Do you think those plethora of platforms is changing the way that trends emerge in the industry? Does it make it easier for industry management to engineer trends?
I don't know if you can engineer trends. I think that you might be able to, well, again, talking about Lady Gaga, you can create a buzz, and just with marketing, it's so easy to get a viral campaign going these days. And if you have the right vibe or come up with some new angle, it's much easier to do now than it was 10 or 20 years ago, because everything is instant, especially with social networking. Once you get a buzz going, you can literally go from hundreds of hits to millions of hits in a couple hours. And that was kind of unthinkable, 10, 20 years ago. And so that's a good thing. And people who are smart are going to be able to manipulate that and help their artists, make them noticeable. Now, whether that can translate into a career, does that translate into ticket sales at a show? Does it translate into, will people actually buy the MP3? Or are they just going to download it illegally? I mean, I think that's what everyone's trying to figure out, is how you can actually make a living from doing that. It's one thing to have a million hits on YouTube or whatever. It's another thing to actually translate that into a way that it can actually earn a living.
Right. Here's the last question for you, and it's kind of a big one. I'm guessing that you're not planning on changing careers anytime soon.
No, I'm not. I'm not planning on changing careers anytime soon. It's too late in the game for me for that.
So when you think about continuing to do this work and imagine the future of the industry, what does it look like?
the future of the music industry is definitely in question. And from my point of view, I have to look at it from two perspectives. One as an artist, how my band Garbage, or I as a songwriter, sort of want to carry forward and figure out ways to get music out there. And the second is how I look at it from a music producer and an engineer and someone who loves to record albums. And now, looking at it from the production standpoint, it's getting really hard to get labels or anybody to commit any decent budgets to go and record. And even a modest budget of 10 years ago, say a band would come in and make a record in 6 or 8 weeks, and the budget would be maybe $100,000 to $150,000. Well, it's a tenth of that now, and everybody wants everybody to work for free or do a spec deal where you do something, you know, you go in and you'll make a mix or work on it, and if they like it, maybe they'll work out a deal and pay you later. And that is difficult. I mean, first of all, our studio, Smart Studios, finally closed in Madison last year. It just got to the point where we weren't getting enough people to come in to keep the doors open. And I know tons of engineers and producers who are struggling out there right now because there's no money for projects. And they're taking indie projects for a couple $100 a day. And a lot of times they're recording them in their basement, in their garage, and just because they want to keep working. And I don't really see that changing anytime soon. I mean, you're still going to get big budget projects like Lady Gaga or Katy Perry or whatever. The Rolling Stones, Mick Jagger can do whatever he wants to do, you know, so he's going to go into a top-tier studio and take as long as he wants to make a record. But for 99.9% of the artists out there, they're going to have to struggle really hard to come up with the money to make a record. And part of that is if you just look at it, it's people don't want to pay for music now. And I think 20 years ago, the way the consumer spent money was more of it probably was spent on, if your free available money was spent on buying records or CDs. And now I think it's probably spent more on video games and possibly going to the movie. I don't know, maybe clothes, maybe going to Hot Topic, you know, I don't really know. But all I know is that in terms of where the percentage of your disposable income that was given to music has diminished greatly. So, and that's not going to change anytime soon.
Does that worry you for the future of the industry?
It does. But, I mean, everybody's going to have to adapt. Like I said, everybody is trying to figure out ways to make records cheap. And I am slowly building up my home studio here, and we did a lot of the Garbage record here. There's no overhead. I can get up in my pajamas in the morning, come down and record guitar parts, and there's no clock and there's no budget running. Almost everybody I know now is starting little home studios or having little places to work where they can work where basically no overhead, so they can have the time to work on a project and not have to worry about the outlay into a proper recording studio. And ultimately, that's going to be the death of the recording studios, which has been happening now for the last 10 years. You know, slowly but surely, all of the great studios are probably going to close their doors. If you look at it, people still want great music. They really do. I mean, people still love music. It's the soundtrack to everything we do. I mean, everything in TV and film, commercials, everywhere you go. You walk into Starbucks and there's music playing. You go into a theater and there's music playing. I mean, any place you go, music is the soundtrack to our lives everywhere. And I think that people are still insatiable for music. It's just whether you're going to be able to allow artists and engineers and producers to sort of carry on the way they did. And since I don't think that's going to happen, I think in some cases what might suffer is the music, the sound of the recordings might start sounding more generic because everyone's using the same laptops and the same plugins to make albums. And you're not going in these great spaces, these environments like Ocean Way Studios or Capitol Studios where you can hear the sound of a room. You know, you can hear the sound of an orchestra or a band playing and that sound comes across the microphones. And there's going to be a whole generation of artists and producers and engineers who don't even know what that is. They're going to know how to make records on their laptop. And there's nothing wrong with that because they can still write a great song. But it's, I think in the long run, sonically, you're going to see, you're not going to get these records that have this great space in the sound of the recording.
It sounds like less room for innovation.
Less room for innovation is what some people might think. And in fact, in some terms, that's sort of what I'm saying. There are people who would argue exactly against me and say, because the music is changing, people are innovating. I mean, there's a lot of new electronica bands like Skrillex out there who is doing great. And he's made these amazing, challenging, really cool electronic records with all these like cut up beats and swooping synthesizers. And it's very edgy and distorted. And it's really cool. And there's a whole generation of young kids now who have embraced that and they love it. And that's, you know, he's a new trend and he's part of a new trend. And that's, there are people who say he's an innovator. And so I guess anytime there's change, what you are going to see is, you're going to see new things happen. And, when I talk about the sound of great space and recordings, I guess that is going to be replaced by the guys who can make great records on their laptops and they can still write a great song. And if they can, they're still going to find a mainstream audience.